Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Binal of binalofamerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio. It is May 13th, 2006, and we have a very special edition of Binal of America Audio for you this week. You see, folks, sometimes Binal of America Audio, it's not just about the superstar, A-list, celebrity, esoteric guests. It's not just about the Jim Marses, the Stanton Friedmans, the Richard Dolanses. It's not just about those guys. Sometimes it's about folks whose work I come upon accidentally or through serendipitous events, and I say, wow, this is amazing stuff. I've never really heard much from this guy. So I bring him on the show. I get him on Binal of America Audio, and hopefully they can get some more exposure, some national exposure, and when you hear him on the big-time radio shows out there, you can say, wait a minute, I heard that guy on Binal of America Audio like last year. So that's the whole point of it, folks. We're not just talking about the superstars. We're talking about the superstars of tomorrow. And this week, we're bringing you, possibly, a superstar of tomorrow, Joe Fex, alternative Sasquatch researcher. He's got a ton of fascinating and thrilling and really mind-boggling stuff. You're going to really dig it, I think. If you don't know much about Joe Fex, let me give you his bio. Joe Fex is the founder and curator of the Apex Research Archives, which houses one of the most extensive paranormal-related photographic and rare data research archives in the Midwestern region, including some of the oldest known UFO photos and Sasquatch documents of the modern age, dating back into the mid-1800s, as well as documents reflecting phenomena in ancient times. Fex has had a lifetime of first-hand paranormal experiences, prompting his extensive studies and pursuits into the unknown, and his explorations have led to many highly controversial theories and heated debate. He has served as consultant and provided research assistance to many of the most renowned and respected minds in paranormal science in most fields of research, and is internationally recognized as one of the nation's top minds in the fields of Sasquatch and UFO studies. He has dedicated over 16 years to the collection and study of data, 12 years of research assistance in public education, and nearly a decade of private and public lectures throughout the western United States. He's conducted several expeditions with groundbreaking results and is currently living in Denver, Colorado, and collecting notes for various papers, articles, and books for publication and lecturing. His website is www.ufothinktank.com, and then click the Apex Research button in the top right-hand corner. Or, if you want to do it the more complicated way, go to www.ufothinktank.com/apexresearch/index.html. Let me read it out for you. www.ufothinktank.com/apexresearch/index.html. That's the long version, or just go to ufothinktank.com and click the Apex button in the top right-hand corner. Without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on May 7th, 2006. Joe Fex on Binal of America Audio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binal of America Audio. This week's guest is Joe Fex. We had a very serendipitous way this interview came about when I was at the X Conference 2. Last April, not this past April, but the previous one, I was looking through the DVD rack because my friend there, Ted St. Rain, was taping it, and he has the DVDs from many conferences all over the world that he has on display when he's selling the DVDs. But anyway, he said I could just grab some that I liked and that looked interesting, and I'm looking through, and here's one that says Alternatives in Sasquatch and Bigfoot Research, Joe Fex. So I picked that up, brought it home, and watched it, and then when we were putting together Binal of America Audio, Joe Fex was on the list of guests, and then ironically enough, this past week, the guy we were supposed to interview, something came up, he couldn't do the interview, and right before that happened, I got an email from someone saying, you should have Joe Fex on your show. So it was like, you know what, they're right, I should have Joe Fex on the show. I rewatched the DVD, sent an email off to Joe Fex, and here he is on Binal of America Audio. Joe Fex, welcome to the show.
How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing great. Well, Joe, why don't we start out first with, give me your background, because you're sort of on the fringe of Bigfoot research, and like I said, I had just discovered you last year. I haven't seen you really too much myself. I'm just sort of getting into the research. You're pretty well known in the underground, but why don't you give some background, some bio, and how you got into alternative research in general.
Okay, well, some would call it fringe, but some of us like to think of it as advanced. there's actually many different researchers that have been around for a long time. A lot of them a lot of them are known by subculture, and few of them are known to the mainstream. And the extent of their work is even less known to the mainstream. For instance, all the Bigfoot researchers can identify with Ivan T. Sanderson, who, wrote one of the most definitive works in scientific examinations of the phenomenon. But none of those researchers in Sasquatch research are willing to go as far as to look at all the other things that this great scientist was studying. I got involved with the stuff primarily when I was growing up in the early 70s. It was mainstream pop culture. It was mainstream media and things of this nature. And for the first time, there was a real explosion of all kinds of different documentaries and movies and books and fiction-based horror films and things like this, dealing with different paranormal fields and elements. And at a young age, I had several different experiences with UFOs and things of this like. And that really opened my mind to the possibilities of, you know, there's a serious nature to a lot of this stuff, and there was enough serious people looking at it that grabbed my attention that weren't like the outback farmer that had UFOs landing in his fields, or, you know, the hillbilly in the middle of the woods that had Bigfoot in his backyard. These guys were accredited, esteemed, and many very pioneering scientists that were widely recognized up until the point they started looking into these things. And I learned one primary lesson from Ivan Sanderson's works. I'd say by the time I was in fifth grade, I learned the fundamental of, if everybody's telling you not to look at it, that's when you need to look at it.
Yeah.
And I've kind of adhered by those kind of policies and that way of thinking. And it's gone from one area into the other, and I never really intended to mix different fields of phenomena together. I just had a primary interest in Bigfoot and UFOs.
Yeah.
But as time goes on, the more research and raw data you examine in conjunction with a lot of the research and data that others have collected, had underlying elements of them that connected these things to other different various types of phenomena. For instance, many people that see UFOs, right,
yep,
have telepathic or physical contact, conscious contact, with alien entities and landed craft. Okay, so there's one field, UFOs, branching out into the field of the contactee enigma,
yep,
and the abduction phenomena, two other different fields. The mutilation scenario, for instance, is very, very distinctly tied into the UFO field. Few people know it, but the Sasquatch are often seen at these scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Not interacting with the mutilations, but nearby. People nearby report the Sasquatch, and people on site where the mutilation occurs also report the Sasquatch. The UFO people don't know how to deal with those kind of cases, and the Bigfoot people won't even look at them. And we're just reaching a point in research to where a lot of the people that had come to these same avenues before and inadvertently went from one field of research into looking to the details of another field of research because they kept running across it, those pioneering minds really completed a lot of these theories back in the early 60s. People like Stan Gordon, John A. Keel, Sanderson, again, was one of them. There were a lot of people that really saw how these things lined up and connected and knew that there was a relativity. But none of the fields involved were prepared to start assembling those connections.
Yeah.
They were still wrestling with the reality of the initial phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
In their own rights, you know?
Yeah.
And so throwing in different phenomenon like UFOs with the Sasquatch, well, what was a simple theory, Sasquatch being an ape or a caveman, it's now becoming more complex once you throw the UFO thing into it.
Yeah.
Once you throw the telepathy thing into it, it becomes even grossly more complex, because then that drags you into intelligence and culture and all kinds of weird things that are going on.
Yeah.
But anybody who's honest with the Sasquatch research will tell you that occasionally, it's not real prominent, but we do have a steady heartbeat, the signal that keeps coming through research. X amount of reports that you take in will net X amount of reports that involve nearby phantom panther sightings, nearby UFO sightings, sometimes by the same witnesses in the same spot, although that is rare. It does happen. And everybody in UFO research is aware that there are many different UFO cases that are prominent and very well established that also have these other phenomena involved with Sasquatch and, you know, poltergeists, for instance, seem to follow heavy UFO activity. We have a case out here in Colorado like that, to where the assembly of scientists that were assembled, this is the third crew of scientists to examine this case, are perplexed because every crew of scientists that comes in is prepared to deal with a set number of phenomena, mainly around the UFO enigma, because this guy's clearly an abductee. We have all the evidence to that. He's clearly having contacts on a subconscious level. We have all the evidence of that. They're around him all the time. He's got tons of clear videotape. And at the same time, we're getting kinetic energies. We're getting invisible phantoms moving around that are occasionally caught on film, caught on video, orbs, streams of some type of burst of energy, all these different things that are more liking to a parapsychology crew as opposed to a ufologist or a physics crew. And the case keeps going round and round with these teams of researchers because they're kind of overwhelmed with the stuff they're not familiar with. And what they need is they need a comprehensive gathering of many different fields that are prepared to understand and respect each other's work, you know, and acknowledge that each other's field of expertise is valid, because they all are valid. There's no paranormal phenomenon that simply does not exist, in my view. You know, some are rarer than others, like human combustion is a very rare phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We still know, after all this time, we still know next to nothing about it.
Yeah.
All the theories, when put to the test, don't seem to pan out. They need a comprehensive crew. And back in the 60s, there were several different bodies of science that had started assembling things like that. Jim and Coral Lorenzen, for instance, were primarily ufologists and very well respected in the field, and later branched out into all these other different areas of strangeness, you know. And they formed several groups. Ivan Terence Sanderson formed a group called the C2 Group, the Society for the Investigation of the Unexplained. And it was, for the first time, it was an assembly of some of the most pioneering minds in a whole group of different fields of science. All of them worked together, all of them lived at the same complex, all of them conducted their studies, and were in perfect tune with one another. You know, where anybody that is into the paranormal fields knows that the biggest obstacle to overcome isn't public awareness, it isn't government resistance, it's the sociology within these groups.
Yeah.
It's impossible to assemble a Bigfoot group or UFO group without all of these sociological things coming into play and it ending up in a big pile of more energy spent on squabbling and idiocy, dominant control and things like this, than energy spent actually comprehensively or critically studying the data.
Yeah. So would you say your area of research sort of is focused on the areas where these different disciplines bleed into each other?
In a lot of ways, yeah. Yeah, it's beginning to tie these different fields together and really get to the core of what their relevancy with each other is.
Yeah. One of the things that you were talking about on the DVD that I saw and we were talking about in the pre-interview was this Janice Carter Coy story. You said it's very popular in your speaking engagements and things like that. So
yeah.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about this, because I had never heard of it, but it sounds like a fascinating case.
Well, in brief, that particular talk that you're talking about that you have on DVD was actually, we didn't know it at the time, or we had just received news of it. There had been an attempt to have an expedition to the area after a few years of working with the witnesses and on-site researchers.
Yeah.
And that expedition was somewhat sabotaged. All the computers were crashed at the same time, everybody involved, all these different things going on, and it hindered it. And so we decided from that point that no one could know when we were dispatching for this expedition.
Oh, wow.
And when we did find out, we had 48 hours to gear up and head out. And at that same talk, just prior to me giving that lecture, I had just received news that we had 48 hours to load up and get out of Dodge and head out to the area.
Oh, wow.
And so it was so secretive that even we didn't know. The crew that was going had no idea if and when we were really going. And we had to keep it absolutely silent until I was within 45 minutes of Mary Green, the primary investigator, 45 minutes of her house is when we called her. We called her at 12:30 in the night and let her know that we were there. And there was a window of time where Janice and Mary and all these people involved knew that we could show up at any given point in time.
Oh, wow.
You know, but we didn't want to risk emails or phone calls or anything like this that would indicate a precise matter of time, because the first sabotage ended up costing quite a bit of money. So we didn't want that to repeat itself.
Okay, well, why don't you catch the audience and I up to date on what the story is all about and the origins of it and things, so maybe bring us up to this expedition that you were just talking about.
Okay, well, a lot of people aren't really familiar with the fact that there's been, in recent years, there's been a growing number of what we call contact cases. I've got them, Dr. Jack Lapsaritis has got them, Tom Powell's got them, there's several going on in Tennessee, and these are primarily cases in which people have either an extremely high prominence of Bigfoot activity in their immediate vicinity, or people have had long-term social interactions with these guys. In rare instances, like what we're going to talk about with the Coy case, language and contact have distinctively been established. And many new things are being learned directly from the sources, from the Sasquatches themselves. And we also use this information as researchers amongst each other to cross-reference and double-check what a lot of these new witnesses are saying.
Yeah.
Because now that it is publicly known to some extent, now we can start expecting people to start fabricating these types of cases. And where before, you know, 5 years ago, it wasn't really a problem because nobody knew what was going on.
Yeah.
No one had written about it. Nobody had said anything. And with the Coy case, primarily, to summarize it in brief, back in the early to mid-1940s, a man named Robert Carter in Tennessee was clearing land, and he was cutting trees down. For days he had the feeling that someone was watching him, but he couldn't determine who. And out there in this remote area of Tennessee, he felled a tree, and that tree struck a being and pinned it to the ground. The being was small, looked like a young child, and he was covered with hair. And so Carter cut off the tree around him, scooped him up, took him back to the farmhouse, and bandaged him up and cleaned up his wounds, and went out trying to locate who this person belonged to. He had no idea what to think of it, and the only thing he could relate it to was a deformed child.
Oh.
So this is what he went around to his neighbors inquiring about without luck. And upon returning home, his Native American neighbor called his attention and pointed out to him that you don't have a child here. What you have is you have a young Sasquatch, and if I were you, I'd get rid of it, because Mom and Dad are going to come looking for it.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be involved with them. And so from there, he locked it into a stall in the barn, because by the time he got home, he found that the kid had torn up his whole house.
Oh, man.
They don't do very well on the indoors. They seem to have a different thermostat than we do, and they start acting like a wild animal in a cage when they are, like, locked in a house.
Yeah.
And I've seen this happen several times as well. And so that's one thing that they really don't get along with. So he took it out of the house, and he took it out to the barn, put it into a stall, and lo and behold, a night or two later, Mom and Dad came back, tore the doors off the barn, tore the doors out of the stall, and took off with their kid. Anyway, in the weeks and months and later years that followed, this young Sasquatch kept coming back and observing this guy working out in the field and watching him. And after a period of time, Carter started talking to him. And he just, almost like talking to himself, he would just talk in a soothing manner and just kind of occupy his day out in the field by talking to someone he knew was out there, but he couldn't see him. And eventually, this culminated into an area of trust to where the Sasquatch subject was able to get closer to him. He was able to get closer to the Sasquatch, so on and so forth, and eventually developed into a very in-depth relationship to where it lasted for the rest of their lives. And Carter, of course, died in 96, I think. But where the story really comes into play is a handful of years ago, a woman named Janice Carter Coy, someone in Tennessee along lines of conversation here and there, word eventually got back to a researcher named Mary Green that there was a woman in this area who had grown up with these guys her whole life and had known them quite well, known them like neighbors and family.
Yeah.
And it turns out Mary went in to investigate it and talked with the witness and was hit with a landslide of data.
Yeah, I bet.
From a whole lifetime.
Yeah.
Of being around these beings. Janice told me that when she was, up until the point when she was about 18 or so, she left home from this remote area and went to college and really got into socializing and interacting somewhat with the modern world. She had heard of a movie called Bigfoot that was The Mysterious Monsters. It was a documentary by Robert Gwinnett back in the 70s. And she had met a guy and they had gone on a few dates and he took her out to the theater and they went and saw this movie. And that was the first time that it ever really dawned on her that this was odd. She had known them since she was 6 years old.
Yeah.
And never really left home, so never knew that these things weren't prevalent in everybody's backyard. She thought this was just an average common thing. And we see this element over and over again because most of the people in these contact situations and scenarios are in remote locations and don't have much access to modern civilization as most of us know it.
Yeah.
Now, they have cable TV and things, but, you know, that and Walmart is about the extent of technology in their immediate vicinity. And a lot of these people are prone to living and dying and never leaving where their heritage is. And so, yeah, it was really interesting. And I started going over Mary Green's data and started seeing consistencies in a lot of the matters that I've been studying and investigating for years and years, that these elements weren't available in anything published. They weren't available in 99% of any journal of any kind. No one wrote books about them. They wrote books about Bigfoot being an ape. They wrote them about him being a hominid, a relict hominid, or a Neolithic caveman, or a missing link of some sort.
Yeah.
But always directing it to the simplest explanation.
Yeah.
It's an evolutionary oddity, or an evolutionary missing piece.
Yeah.
So they immediately tied it to the biological. If you go into records, into the Neolithic periods with the Native Americans, into the modern Native American cultures, and then into the 30s and the 40s, the 20s, with the miners and the loggers encountering mountain devils and wild men, and these are the terms they used to call them,
mm-hmm.
Before Bigfoot or said, before the Indians told us who they were. All of these things report over and over again, not only physical encounters, but also really abstract psychological interactions and abstract experiences that involve, you know, noises without anything coming from it or anything to emanate from, seemingly coming out of nowhere. Here's one that few people know about, but is very consistent in Sasquatch research, and we get a lot of this from rangers. Is the sound of machines underground, as if there were a giant industrial old world factory underground in the remote mountains.
Weird.
And people can hear this noise, but they can never locate it. And this happens in the heart of where there's, you know, Bigfoot presence. And so I started seeing a lot of these distinctive parallels. What she was saying to the surface Bigfoot community, or the popular Bigfoot community, was completely new, unheard of, and completely insane. She was reporting that these guys were telepathic. They could read minds. They could remote view. They could vanish from sight. They can walk without leaving footprints. They can interact with the human mind on almost hypnotic levels. They can influence the human mind in several different ways.
Yeah.
And also with UFO interaction. You know, she had spent a period of years asking these guys questions and them telling her their own versions of what reality was like and what they interact with and what their world was like.
Yeah.
How they communicate and interact with each other and all of this. And a lot of it to Janice seemed really outlandish because she didn't know anything about UFOs. She didn't know anything about Phantom Panthers or anything like this. One interesting thing is I'd always, for years, noticed the Phantom Panther presence with the Sasquatch. Anywhere there's a very heavy reporting of activity in an area, there's going to ultimately be Phantom Black Panthers reported in that same area by different people that don't know that there's a big Bigfoot wave going on.
Yeah.
And vice versa. The Bigfoot people have no clue that Phantom Panthers and lions and things like this are things that are just completely outrageous but just as consistent as the Sasquatch enigma are breaking out in rashes in these same areas. And in the meantime, you know, the police are taking calls of with people reporting strange lights in the sky moving around the woods and things like this. And as I said, these things are extremely prominent, but they're prominent enough. They're consistent.
Yeah.
And for something that isn't written about and something that the public doesn't have any resource to learn about, you simply can't hook something that you don't have any knowledge of.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, well, that's one of the areas of expertise that I get into is archaic documents that by long and far predate the age of UFOs and the, you know, public knowledge of the Sasquatch and all these things. And some of my documents, my original documents, go back into the early 1800s, reporting the same things that we get from abduction victims now. Reporting lights in the sky in an age when there was no electricity. Reporting contact with other beings in an age when there was no such thing as science fiction. These things weren't even in the public mind yet. So that whole concept of, well, people just see things, you know, because we watch a lot of fiction and we live in an artificial world and a world of technology and such a fast-paced information age that it stresses the mind. And some psychologists try to explain all of these encounters away through these means, but what they haven't examined the phenomena enough or in depth enough to see that these things go back to the very dawn of man.
Yeah.
There's no period where these things have not been prevalent and haven't been identified and haven't been wondered about. And so, yeah, that was one of my first levels of confirming the data that Janice was giving me after Mary had given me a comprehensive briefing. And we had gotten to a point of Janice willing to talk to me and really open up and get into some of these areas that already the Bigfoot people wouldn't even listen to. So when I came into contact with Janice was when she was first starting to repel from the Bigfoot community because of all this hostile and disrespectful activity. People were just saying the worst things about this woman when they had no idea of what she was saying. You know, many of them had never even read the report. They had just heard or been told some of the elements of it, and those elements didn't conform with their theories of who the Bigfoot are. And so they immediately ditched them and immediately hopped on this bandwagon of witch hunters that assaulted Mary Green and Janice Carter-Croy and several other people that have reported these things.
Yeah.
Simply because they honestly reported it. Back in the 60s, there were several researchers that came to these same conclusions. And they had found similar cases. The same thing happened. The research communities themselves attacked them and then systematically suppressed all of that data.
Oh, wow.
And one of my big problems with the Bigfoot research community at large, not all of them, mind you, but most of them, is this policy of if I think something is lunatic fringe or if I think something is invalid, no matter how consistent the reports keep coming in, I'm going to withhold that from what I write. I'm going to withhold it from the public ever finding out about it. And worse off, any time I do get backed into a corner and I have to talk about it, I'm going to talk about it in the context that this comes from the minds of you know, mentally disturbed individuals. They call it lunatic fringe.
Yeah.
And it's really unfounded. Most of these people are very, very intelligent, very sincere, have impeccable reputations and are decent people that have no interest in becoming the focal point of any of these research communities. They just felt that their information was important and somebody should document it.
Yeah.
And were good enough to give a lot of us over the years those opportunities to do that. In Coy's case, I was astounded at how far she was willing to allow this to intrude on her life, you know. And because she doesn't live on the property anymore. She's, you know, doing her best to establish a normal life at this point. And she's in seclusion. She doesn't want to talk to anybody about it anymore, which is terrible. Right when we were starting to learn a great deal of it was the breaking point for this witness.
And what kind of information did you glean from her experiences with the Bigfoot?
Well, one of the first things I addressed was I had noticed all this panther activity, and that's one of my fields of great interest.
Yeah.
Because it's such a global thing, and it happens everywhere, but people just don't think that it's odd as much as they do with a Sasquatch, because a panther is somewhat feasible as a physical explanation.
Yeah.
But it didn't explain why these guys were always around Bigfoot areas. And one of the first things that I had her ask when I had her act as a go-between between me and the Sasquatch, I had her conduct several little interviews with them and ask specific questions, things like this. And I asked them, you know, what is the deal with these panthers? Panthers always seem to manifest around you guys? And their response was, they had asked if we were familiar with Native American spirituality and their connections with the wolf as a spirit guide. And, you know, of course, most of us were. And they summed it up by saying, well, that's what the deal is with the panthers. They're our spirit guides. It's really interesting that they should say that, because the Bigfoot in Tennessee, these Sasquatch individuals on the Coy farm, have slit eyes like a cat's.
Yeah.
It's very strange, because this is not something that's found in primates. It's something that is predominantly known in raptors and reptiles and the domestic cat. A lot of people don't know the domestic cat has an eye structure like this, but the big cats don't. It sets them apart.
Yeah.
And they're actually from two different families. The feline lineage is just as empty-hearted as the Homo sapien lineage, in the respect that there's this big gap that Homo sapien kind of looks like an ape, but we don't have any of the evidence in between to bring us through those stages of evolution. And the domestic cat is the same thing with the big cat families.
Yeah.
We presume, because they look like big cats, only smaller, that they're direct evolutionary processes of these families, but there really is no fossil record to back that up. And so it makes them as unique as we are, and I suppose as unique as the Sasquatch are.
Yeah. Now, aside from the Phantom Panther stuff, you mentioned that sort of like you allude to an oral history of the Bigfoot that you guys sort of got from the Bigfoot. Can you elaborate on that at all?
That whole piece of information came about from a long stream of other pieces of information when we were trying to extract exactly what is your association with the UFOs. Are you familiar with what we're saying here? Do you know what these things in the sky are? And do you know anything about where they come from or who may be piloting them? And they were very familiar with it. And they call them star people, which is not the first time we've seen this reported in association with Sasquatch. We have Brad Steiger, of course, has that wonderful old report of a mountaineer's diary, in which this guy had lived with Indian tribes for many years. And he had wintered down with a native tribe one year and noticed that a brave would take this huge platter of meat up into this mountain, be gone for several hours, and then come back with an empty tray. And he would do this night after night. And so this guy, according to Steiger, wrote in his journal that he stopped him one night on his way out, and he asked him, where are you taking that meat? And the brave just signaled to him, follow me, and I'll show you. And he took him up into this mountain, and according to Steiger and this artifact he has, I would love to see the original, according to what he says, this journal contained details in which this Native American took him up to this cave in this mountain, and they spent the next 10 or 12 days sitting in this cave with this big, hairy, giant guy that the Indians were kind of caretakers of. and that they brought him food when he needed it. He helped them when they needed it. That they spoke of him psychically healing the natives when they were afflicted. And apparently this white man sat in this cave with this Native American brave acting as an interpreter, asking this Sasquatch all these wild questions about who you are, where do you come from. For the most part, they don't really know. They have an oral history, but as in Tennessee, we see that their concept of timelines is different than ours, so it's hard to place if their ancient oral history and how they tell us is from a history that occurred on this planet or somewhere else, or we don't know.
Yeah.
I'm open to anything at this point. I used to be one of those traditional mainstream Sasquatch researchers, and I'm telling you this, I had my suspicions, but this case really really closed the deal on my whole perspective of who and what we're dealing with here, and it's taken a drastic transformation over the past eight or 9 years. When this mountaineer, or whatever you want to call it, inquired with the Native American on the way down from the mountain, where do these guys come from? He told him the star people bring him, and he said that the star falls from the sky, lands on the ground at a distance from their camp, and little guys in shiny suits get out, push one of these hairy guys out, wave at the camp of natives, and get back into the star and go back into the sky. And he was also told that when they die, or at least when this particular one died, they were supposed to take it to the top of this mountain, and the star people would come and get him and take him to heaven.
Wow.
And so we find consistencies through things like this, artifacts, you know, that have come across from time to time. They're rare, but we do see traces of this in, you know, America's history from the 1700s and 1800s. And so it was really stunning to me that, you know, now that we got these guys up close enough to where we can make distinctive contact and communication with them, they're telling us the same information over and over. And at the dawn of me getting involved in this end of it, I was contemplating the possibility that one of the two has happened. Either Native Americans have taught the Sasquatch a great deal of knowledge, or the Sasquatch have taught the Neolithic Native Americans. And it's really starting to lean towards the possibility of the Sasquatch were probably the origin of a lot of North American Indian beliefs and practices and spirituality, and because it seems they have the same distinctive understanding of the universe around them. And when it comes to paranormal elements, anybody that is a Native American and still deeply involved in their culture would be the first to tell you that their sense of reality is engulfed in the paranormal. They recognize all of this stuff, and that's why they don't fear it as much as modern man does. Modern man has a hard time dealing with all of these things, and people are primarily scared of them, and they shouldn't be. I found that to be very relevant in Tennessee with the contact we established. It's very difficult for a Sasquatch to get close to a person that fears them, and when that person is filled with fear and terror, it sends out a vibration that the Sasquatch can detect and starts to fill them with fear.
Yeah.
And they get agitated. And then they want you to leave. And
yeah.
That doesn't do much for your state at the time either. Your fear culminates to an even larger blast of residual vibrations.
Yeah.
And frequencies of emotional nature. And they pick up more of that, and it just culminates into a bad experience for most people. I've had several hunters over the years ask me, you know, who were really seriously interested in the phenomenon, what do I do if I'm hunting in the woods and I run across one of these guys? And I always tell them the same thing. Open your weapon. If it comes apart from the stock, take it apart, set it on the ground, back up 15 to 20 feet, cross your legs Indian style, and sit down, hold your arms over your knees with your palms up, and bow your head. And they will know that you mean them no harm. This is a physical language that any primitive anywhere on the planet would clearly understand. And it's putting yourself at their mercy. You pose yourself as not being any possible potential threat, and you'll find your experience will be a lot friendlier than they would be if you saw them and the first thing you did was raise a gun.
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time that, you know, when you think about it in human terms, if you came looking for me and you had a gun, I'd be a little hard to locate.
Yeah.
You know, look at it. Don't look at them like animals. Look at them as if they were people. I'm not saying they're people, but I'm saying that they're at an intellectual level to where you can consider them people. They do understand a great deal, and they understand a lot about human behavior, too. My research has shown me that they have spent a considerable amount of time studying us.
Really?
Through the centuries. And we've only begun studying them in 1958.
Yeah. So they may have the leg up there on
right.
Who knows what.
It's one of the things that makes them so elusive, is outside of them having telepathy, is the fact that they have a much deeper understanding. They know 99% of how a human reacts to their presence.
Yeah.
You know, they know exactly, they know, a lot of researchers will tell you stories about how their crews have been herded out of the woods and completely cattle herded in systematic ways. And it's because they have that understanding of how we react and what makes us fearful and all of this kind of noise. Fox expressed in Tennessee a policy or a philosophy, if you will, of their perception of honor, as far as equality was concerned, was what fears me, I dominate. What I fear dominates me. What doesn't fear me and what I do not fear is my equal.
And Fox is the
Fox is the patriarch of Genesis Group.
Yeah, it's the father figure for the
right.
Sasquatch, yeah. That's
the
in contact.
Sasquatch, yeah. And when I was out there, I think there were 9 of them in the group. But the group comes and goes over the years. New ones come in, old ones go on to other groups or other adventures or whatever. And some of them stay for a long period. Some of them are just passing through, and so on and so forth.
And you said you made some kind of expedition down there. You had a brief window of time, and you went down there. Tell me about that. And
right. Well, we had 2 target areas, because Mary Green, the researcher Mary Green, near where she was living, about 20 minutes, 30 minutes away or so, was an area where she had established contact with a group of them, a large group of them, but not to the point of addressing language and things like this,
yeah,
in a dialect, but addressing all the signal languages, throwing pebbles, throwing stones, tapping logs, things like this, clacking rocks together, leaving signs in the woods with bent sticks and things like this.
Yeah.
That she had developed a rapport with, and understands a good deal of a lot of that. And so for years she's been going into this area, establishing communication, bringing them food. And they come close, but they're not like on Janice's property. Most of these guys, like Fox has been around humans his whole life. It's a lot easier for him to come right up to a human than it is for, you know, the typical Sasquatch that just knows we're bad news, you know.
Yeah.
Can't be trusted very much.
Yeah.
And anyway, we went to Mary's place. We were there for an hour or two, getting introduced to her, you know, her team of people that had been assisting her. And it was a great, great little bunch of people, and none of them were extensive researchers. They were all just regular people, regular down-home folks that wanted to help.
Yeah.
And Mary, getting older in age and having some physical difficulties, needed help in sustaining this kind of activity and bringing them food and bonding with them to some degree and all of this kind of noise. And for years they had helped her, and I presume they're still helping her now. But anyway, we left Mary's place after a few hours and went straight into the field. Went in the pitch blackness of 2 o'clock in the morning. We're standing at the end of the Appalachian Mountains, very deep in the mountains and at a dead end. And we go out to a couple of areas, and we set out some calls with some logs and get no responses. And so we move deeper and deeper in. And then we hit the last area that we were going to attempt this at, a short list of areas that Mary's been successful at. As we're going through this gravel one-lane road through the woods, we can see 3 of these guys to our right trailing right alongside of us.
Yeah.
Sort of escorting us in. You can just barely see the outlines of their bodies. You can distinctively see the glow of their eyes. Their eyes were so bright. It was eerie. Their eyes glow distinctively, at least in this particular group of guys. Their eyes glowed like a lime green only very sharp and extremely crisp in color.
Yeah.
And we were traveling approximately 28 miles an hour, and these guys were pacing us right alongside us in the woods.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 30, 40 feet into the woods from the road, pacing us without any problem at all. And they kind of looked like it was really kind of surreal because they just glided through the woods. There wasn't any big racket of trees coming down and stuff being knocked over and stomping and heavy weight and all these kind of things that you would expect.
Yeah.
They just kind of moved through the woods with so much grace that you couldn't really hear them, and they almost looked ghost-like in the ways that they just kind of softly and glided through the woods. And so once we got into the area, parked the cars, turned off everything, everybody started discharging from two or three different vehicles. Mary, at this point, is in drastic physical shape, so she can't really walk too much or walk too far at this juncture. She gets out of the car that she's in, I'm in a van, goes around the side of it, faces the woods, puts out the call, and so she's just standing there next to the car, and at this point it's pitch black because we just shut all the cars off. And I'm feeling my way around the car that she's leaned up against, and I hear her say, "I just got a pebble in." And as soon as she said that, I started hearing these little short barks that they signals that they give to allow you to know that they're approaching and that they're coming closer.
Yeah.
And as soon as she said, "I just got a pebble," I hear this bark, and then a pebble lands right on the top of my right foot. I mean, lands on it with so much precision, it's hard to even fathom. And this is a signal that's more designed to let you know to brace yourself. We're coming in closer.
Yeah.
You know, that this is not going to be a distance thing. We're going to let you know, as opposed to believe, let you know our that we're here and that we're willing to communicate, willing to interact. And midway through all of this, two things happen. I usually carry a micro cassette recorder for my field notes.
Yeah.
But one thing I've learned is that you're getting more success from interacting with these guys if you don't use any of the technologies to record them. They know what the stuff is for. They know why you want tapes and photos and things like this, and they don't like it. They want to commune or interact with people who want to get to know them.
Yeah.
Not people that have fame in mind, fortune, you know, people that have anything to prove to the world. Many years ago when I started out, those were my aspirations, and they no longer are. I'm much more content working with people that are ready to go forward and learn more about it, as opposed to converting the rest of the world that these things are indeed a reality.
Yeah.
And so I get this micro cassette recorder out, and I didn't get it to record them. I got it to record my own commentary. And these are instruments that are tested diligently every time they're loaded. And I pull this thing out, and I turn it on, and it runs for about 3 seconds, and it just stops. The light comes on, it's getting power. No fast forward, no play, no record, no nothing. So I thought, well, okay, that's odd. I'll just go get the other one. Took it back to the van, got that one out, same thing. At that point, I just figured, this is not an accident. Something else is going on here. I can get the picture, you know.
Yeah.
I totally understand. Put the recorder away. So I put the recorders away, come around the car, get the pebble thing, and right when they start coming in very close to us, a latter party who was not really a researcher, he is just kind of this goofy friend of one of the researchers, comes barreling down this dirt road in the middle of nowhere in this Jeep with, you know, tons of wattage of floodlights and, you know, JC lamps and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Barreling down, and it was like, oh, hell was breaking loose. I was beginning to wonder, just watching the light come through the woods, I was beginning to wonder if we weren't about to have a UFO. Because all the racket and the light coming from this thing, and he pulls up to the area, and of course, all the Sasquatch repelled.
Yeah.
I almost repelled. I was like, what the hell is this? Anyway, so we get him settled, and the whole time this guy's, I don't know what to think of this gentleman, but he was just really goofy, you know. The whole time he was there, he was chuckling and giggling, and I don't know, he acted more like a high school student or something, I don't know.
He's an excitable fellow, I guess.
Right. Yeah. he wasn't really taking it serious, and he was adding to a lot of tension, because some of the researchers, a couple of them, are very afraid of him, even though they really shouldn't be, and they know they shouldn't be. It's still an instinct that's hard to overcome, especially when you fully know that these guys are in your immediate vicinity. And so they were already a little nervous, and then this goofy guy coming along, and they compounded it. And so we were standing around for a while, wondering, okay, they're not signaling us now, and they've come to a screeching halt, so let's just sit out here a while and, you know, see what they want to do and let them call the shots. And eventually, as our eyes started getting accustomed to the light, or the lack thereof, because the Appalachian forest here is very tall, and so very little light comes down and hits the ground. Only little open patches of woods can the moonlight hit the ground. And so we have all these little gaps of avenues where we can see moonlight coming through, but just a handful of them. And after about 30 minutes or so, we start noticing things moving in those little areas of light.
Yeah.
And these things are blocking out all the light. You look down this row of trees and you see where the sunlight, maybe 25 yards away, is hitting the ground in an open clearing. And then you look at something else, and then you look back at that same avenue, and you're like, I could have swore there was an open patch of light coming through there.
Yeah.
And then you look back 5 minutes later, and you see the patch of light again. Somebody was standing in between a minute ago, obscuring your view. And so once I had established, okay, they haven't left. Good, they're still here. They're just kind of hesitant. And we started being able to see them move back and forth, because they were kind of large and very black, and over these patches of light, we can see this little song and dance where these guys are sneaking around back and forth, and they seem to be in several different directions. So primarily, the first thing we realize is, whatever happens here tonight, we're surrounded.
Yeah.
These guys are in all directions of us now. And there's a whole large group of them, not just a couple of them. And after a while, I saw a flash of light, low to the ground. And I thought, what was that? So I fixed my eyes on that spot. I just kept watching it. Several minutes go by, and again, I see two lime green lights just above the ground turn on and then turn off. And they were right next to each other, parallel.
Yeah.
And it caught my attention, and I said, okay, I'm going to keep my eyes right on that spot. And every time it repeats, I'm going to move forward towards it a little bit. And I kept doing this, and eventually I was able to pinpoint the exact spot that this light was coming from. And it was the eyes of a Sasquatch crawling on the ground, which was just weird as all get out. They can crawl flat on the ground. I would have never guessed that before I got involved in this end of it. Anyway, I just started walking out into the woods, straight towards, with my eyes transfixed on that one spot, and got maybe 6-7 feet away from him.
Oh, wow.
And squatted down next to him, and just started to talk to him. And in the meantime, you know, several of my colleagues that are, the people from Tennessee that are back at the, where we were parked at, thought I'd completely lost my mind. Because they're still intimidated and afraid of them. And they're also aware that these guys are all over in the woods, and here I am, I just go walking into the darkness, like a stroll in the park.
Yeah.
And he was crawling on the ground, so I didn't think he'd be too much of a threat. It looked more like he was hiding from us, so, as opposed to something that was trying to sneak up on you for negative purposes. And we were able to ascertain by the direction he was going that he was trying to sneak up on a sack of dog food that we had brought out, because people in Tennessee had been feeding them dog food, and they seem to like it okay, so they bring me, 40, 50-pound sacks of dog food out there and leave it out there for him. And
yeah.
Sometimes they come out and get it from him and thank him, and sometimes they just stay at a distance and they leave it there and they get it later after the people have left. But anyway, I spent a good 28 minutes or so crouched down on the ground out there. Tiggers are vicious, by the way. By squatting on the ground next to the Sasquatch, I ended up with a bunch of tiggers in my leg, and I'd never had a tigger before.
Oh, man.
So that was a new one on me. There are parasites that bore holes into you and that itch like crazy. And the only way to get rid of them is to put nail polish over the wound, and it suffocates
them. Oh, Jesus.
But I had my pants taped up. I had my combat boots going with the high ankles on them. And I had about a half a can of off dumped on me. And I couldn't believe these tiggers still bored into my legs.
Oh, man.
But I sat there for about 28 minutes, just calmly and quietly and very softly talking to him like I would a person. And trying to reassure him that there was no one here that had any ill intention and no reason to believe that he would be threatened. There were 12 people there. Approximately. Just repeating this type of communication, hoping to get him relaxed to a point to where he could at least stand up in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, even though where we were was very dark and I couldn't see him very clearly, all I could see is his eyes when he would look up at me. But he kept playing this game as if I'm going to stay perfectly still. You know, and hopefully this guy won't notice me, even though his cover had been blown.
Yeah.
He still refused to get up. But I could look at him eye to eye. This is, like I said, 6 or 7 feet away from me. I can see that I was looking into a large pair of eyes that were looking directly at me. And when he looked up at me, he lifted his head a little bit. And when he closed his eyes again, he kind of tucked his head face down a little bit.
Yeah.
And much to my amazement, there was another brave soul out of the crew, who was Sherry Lee Mallon, who had been involved with Mary Green for some years and also involved in UFO research and such. After about five to ten minutes or so of being out there, she took it upon herself to go walk out in the woods and find out what the hell I was doing out there, because
yeah.
I was out of sight of the people at the site at this point. All they knew is I walked into the darkness, and now they can't see me. And they don't know why or what's going on. And she walked out, and sure enough, he still stayed motionless. He still wouldn't move, you know. And I pointed out to her where he was, and sure enough, she sat there for a few minutes, and he looked up at her. And we, again, for a while, tried to coax him into relaxing to the point to where he could at least stand up and address us in a respectable manner with it. We didn't want him to feel that he needed to hide, or that he needed to feel uncomfortable, or that he needed to sneak up on the dog food.
Yeah.
And try to allow him to know that we brought it there for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, following the advice and following the research of Dr. Lapsaritis, and in conjunction with some of my UFO colleagues, Dr. Leo Sprinkle, several avenues of research have taught us that when interacting with these things, one has to be very careful of what one thinks, and that what you are thinking has a lot to do with the degree of your interaction, whether it's a good thing, bad thing, hostile thing,
yeah,
a fleeting thing. And the best thing to do is to remain calm in your mind and to think about what it is you would want this person or this being to know, you know? And so at the same time I'm speaking these words, understanding that he probably doesn't know much of English, if any, that if the telepathic theory is correct, then he will at least be able to receive those transmissions as a thought wave.
Yeah.
And he never did get up, and so after, like I said, about a half an hour of this, I acknowledged to him thanks for not being so intimidated that he left.
Yeah.
Thanks for not being intimidating towards me, because he could have made me leave very easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let him know that, you know, I recognize that you're uncomfortable, and I'm going to leave now. Thank you for this experience, and I'll be on my way, and here's this sack of dog food and other various forms of food for you guys, that you can come out when we're gone. We're not going to come back, and we're not going to try to, you know, wait till you're in the food and then come out and jump on you or anything. You guys are free and welcome to it. And we left from the site at that point. And at that point, I'm still wondering about the telepathy thing. I'm seeing a lot of research that agrees with it in several different areas, including the Sasquatch thing. But as far as my own personal experience, to where, okay, I believe the theory, but I don't know it as a fact. I haven't seen it in action. And once I got to Janice's place, this was confirmed in so many different ways. It wasn't even funny.
Yeah.
I saw it demonstrated so many times to where Fox could read my mind and then transmit to Janice exactly what he was reading. And she would just spew out things that, you know, that I hardly even remembered was in my brain.
Yeah.
Things about my life, things about my childhood, things about all kinds of stuff that this woman had no way of knowing.
Yeah.
No way. Not in the farthest reaches, and if she did, the only avenue I could tell is if she was telepathic. You know, and if she was telepathic, why would she be fabricating the Bigfoot thing? You know?
Yeah.
I believe that all things are telepathic, it's just that most people are tuned out or turned off from it. If most people experience psychic activity, they just don't recognize it. Now, most people call it coincidences. When you're thinking about somebody and then they call you, or you're talking about somebody and then you run into them, you know? I've seen incidences like that happen so often that it's impossible for me to establish it in my own mind as a coincidence. And I've seen it in research as well, to where different things are placed at the same place at the same time for specific other things to occur. And it gets quite complex at that point, and there are people now that are like Dr. Sprinkle and Dr. Claude Swanson in Colorado Springs are now very seriously studying it and coming to some really profound theories and conclusions that are quite digestible and eye-opening that help a person see how these things are entirely connected. They're in like a synchronistic ballet with each other, all this phenomena is.
Yeah.
And we seem to be spectators that are standing in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Just looking at the dancers in all directions, wondering what show to watch for the moment and what to make of it.
Yeah.
How to absorb it.